Commander Eppard, Reel 31. Now, you were telling me about these Chinese filmmakers.
The Chinese film industry was cornered by two brothers who had become millionaires in the 1930s because they had invented something called Tiger Balm. What it was made of, I haven't the foggiest idea, but if you rubbed it on, it cured absolutely everything under the sun. And the Chinese bought it in huge sums. It was a complete fantasy. But they made this vast sum of money out of this cure-all remedy, and they went into horse racing, particularly up in Hong Kong, where I was the governor's guest at one time, seeing their horses run and betting on every race, but nothing like the enthusiasm the Chinese did. And their name was Shaw. There was Run, Run, Shaw, and Run Me, Shaw. And down in Singapore itself, and in Hong Kong, they had very large gardens, which were fantasy gardens of devils and tortures and so on, with absolutely nothing spared in the way of blood pouring out of the sides of people being tortured for not doing what they should have done in this life, but in the afterlife having a bad time. And the family in Singapore invited me to dinner. And to my intense surprise, this very Chinese family, because I was there, invited me to have dinner in a totally gorgeous English antique setting in their dining room, with Queen Mary dining tables, lovely silver and all the rest of it. As the chief guest, I was caught totally flat aback by being offered sucking pig, apparently to chew in a silver dish, and being told to help myself. Well, as far as I could see, the sucking pig was totally intact, sitting in the dish. And I found that it had, in fact, been already carved, but with a razor blade. You couldn't see where the junctions were. So I had to be shown how, with chopsticks, it was possible to lift out a chunk of this and put it on one's plate. Then I found that the children of the house were out for the weekend from Malvern or Cheltenham, because they were at school in England. And they were sort of English public school boys with Chinese faces and multi-millionaire Chinese parents. So the Tiger was the okay brand name. And the Tiger Brewery produced beer. And the sailors, when asked in England what beer they would like to have, absolutely refused. The concept of Chinese beer was something they couldn't think about even. So I had to bring out a very large amount of beer because the Admiralty rules had just allowed sailors to buy beer in the evening on board within limits. And I managed to stow 10 tons of beer in Belfast. We'd sailed from England. But time being passing, they drank all that. And they had discovered Tiger beer. They thought Tiger beer was marvelous by then. But I wouldn't have 10 tons of Tiger beer on board because it was available to be bought ashore in all the places we went to. And it was a measure of the spread of the influence of Run Me Shore and Run Run Shore, at least one of whom had been a friend of Lord Mountbatten, sharing the an interest in the movie industry. So quite fascinating. However, when Christmas came of 1960, knowing that we were going to hand over the commission to the next lot and go home early in 61, the Christmas celebrations were just a little sad, to say the least of it. And so going the rounds of on the mess decks in the traditional sense, Christmas, I found that some of my sailors, one particularly in the forecastle's mess, had decided that they should dress themselves up by standing in the spit kids. I could explain what that is if you're not quite sure. But in the old days, the sailors chewed tobacco, and it was not thought to be a good thing to spit on the floor. So a vessel was provided, rather larger than the ordinary jerry, made of something you could polish. And you were invited to spit into your spit kid. Well, the spit kids were still placed in the mess decks every day, and they had to be kept spotless. But most of the sailors didn't chew tobacco. You still could get chewing tobacco, but not many of them did. and it was used for fag ends and for waste paper and all the rest of it. And they had to be inspected from time to time. And one of my sailors, who felt he'd been rubbished a bit by something or other in the forecastle division, decided that he would face the rounds going round the ship by standing in the spit kit and covering himself in loo paper. And there was the need to laugh like a drain at something I didn't really understand at the time. There was a photograph of that going on. And Chief Petty Officer Kwok, the chief cook in the wardroom, produced the most marvelous Christmas cake with flashing lights and all the rest of it for the wardroom to eat. But in the whole of the commission, although he'd made a cake rather like that for my youngest daughter before we left home, he still hadn't learned how to make the cake inside at the end of 18 months. But I didn't like to tell him because it was such a beautifully looking cake. And the ship alongside in Singapore was dressed overall with Christmas lights up on the foremast and so on. And I had a major children's party for all the locals in Singapore to bring their children on board. And there was the very last copy of the Belfast Bugle, which was the ship's newspaper that I mentioned before. A very sad thing to produce, as you would imagine. And I felt quite strongly that we had done something quite exceptional on that ship, and many of the sailors obviously did too. I admired them enormously for what they did, but everything I wanted them to do. And the only time that the captain made it clear that he thought anything of them at all was in the leading article to the last of the Belfast Bugles, when he congratulated the editorial work of the Belfast Bugle on their excellent work and their splendid last number. He then thanked Arthur Webb's department for their Christmas meals provided as good as the previous year, and a Merry Christmas to everybody and the next at home with your families. And that was that. He wasn't really, I found, seen as a person at all by the ship's company. It was very, very sad. My Christmas message to them was a very different sort of thing. Do you remember at Devonport in 1958? Red hull, only one funnel. And that one was yellow. Not much structure above, B-gun turret, A-turret missing. Red and yellow above, dirt and rust below, a dead ship. With dockyard help, we've achieved something to remember since then, for she's alive and beautiful now, and everyone knows it out here. You can be proud of what you've done, not only with the ship, but in the name of Belfast too, the city of Belfast, where she was built. It would be ungrateful not to single out defaulters for a special Christmas mention. These men have contributed more of their time to the ship's work than anyone else, and you should be thankful. They all got extra work, of course, when they were defaulters. After all, they've done a lot of work which would otherwise have come your way. I think they've now realized this, because the number of offenses has halved in the last quarter, and at this rate we'll have none at all by the end of January. Today we share Christmas, tomorrow, and for the rest of our lives, we share memories. So the bullshit bit did get into these sort of things as well. And I was very happy to keep that, and the various people who were in that commission did actually enjoy themselves. She was a ship to remember. And to my intense surprise, when we came alongside for the last time after trials, having got out of the dockyard, we had to prove the ship still worked with the existing ship's company. My amazement, the captain said while we were still out in Singapore streets, take her back alongside, Commander. And with the commissioning, the paying off pennant, flying, way out longer than the ship, I brought alongside. Wonderful experience.
Now, there's one particular story that I think you know we want to hear about, if you could tell that, because I think it illustrates this thing about your relationship with the crew.
You may remember that one of the Chinamen under contract to me personally on board, one of about 30 Chinamen, had suffered internal bleeding in the South China Sea and had been flown ashore to Okinawa. It was thought that he might die in the ship, and that would have been very bad cess indeed. So we got him out by squeaking to the nearest land, which happened to be Okinawa, and the Americans sent out a helicopter which picked him up from the ship. A very hairy business. We had to cut all the ventilation trunking off the mushrooms off the quarterdeck. However, with great relief, he got off. And a matter of months later, he appeared on board, grinning from ear to ear, at Hong Kong. And he handed me a letter. And when I read it, I found that it was a bill for £5,000 from the Americans. Well, I was happy. I'd complied with the station orders about landing people like that. I was covered. But when I read the fine print of the station orders, I found that I should have landed a sick man for treatment in a Commonwealth or Empire country, which shows how far out of date those standing orders were in the Far East. So I discovered the hard way that the £5,000 bill was all down to me, because this man was under contract to work for me, not for the Queen. So back in Hong Kong, faced with this bill, I was a very worried man indeed. And at the end of a week, the chief gunner's mate, who ran my office with the gunnery officer, the commander's office, doing daily orders and all that sort of thing, came up to me and said, in a way which seemed rather odd to me, was I by any chance going ashore? And I said, well, I hadn't decided, chief. What's this all about? Well, so he said, one or two of us, chief of the officers, were going ashore for a drink, and they wondered if I would be kind enough to join them. Well, that was so unusual and so way out of anything I'd heard about before. I said, yeah, I think I probably will go ashore. Where are you meeting? So I was told which bar to go to. And in due course, having put on my dog robbers, I appeared ashore. Have a drink, said the... And I found nearly all the chief petty officers in the ship were there. And I said, come on. I want to know what this is before I have anything. I've never met anything like this before. Well, so, have a drink first. And I said, no, not going to. What is it? Well, sir, you know you've been saying that the Liberty men have been fairly smart in the last few days. I said, well, they have. I noticed particularly the Liberty men were very smart going ashore. And I was very pleased with that. Why? Well, sir, they'd like for you to have this, sir. They gave me a cheque for £5,000. So I wouldn't touch it. I said, now, I want to know where this has come from and why. I can't take money like this. So they explained that all the Liberty men had had it explained to them by the petty officers and chief petty officers who were responsible for inspecting them and so on, falling them in for the officer watch to inspect them, that I had a problem and they might like to take tickets in a raffle for £100. And it would be nice if they took enough tickets in the raffle to perhaps provide this check. And if by chance they didn't have enough money to buy tickets in the raffle, they weren't allowed ashore because they weren't smart enough, were they? And by whatever pressure had been brought upon them by my chief petty officers, without my knowledge at all, the fact was they had collected £5,000, which was handed to me to get me out of trouble. And it was, I had the drink then with them. I needed one after that, as you would imagine. But I was overwhelmed by this. It was a gesture I couldn't have imagined in any circumstances. So I was very, very proud that they felt like this, and they'd done it off their own bat, so there was no suggestion of any sort. What was the other story you were on
about? The other story was about the conditions when the ship was battened down for nuclear...
The introduction of... It was atomic, ballistic, nuclear, no, ABC, atomic, ballistic, and chemical warfare. was the in thing. Quite clearly, the Russians, as I knew from my intelligence job, had been doing rather curious things. And nuclear missiles had, after all, been around since the end of the war. And ships like Belfast, built before the war, of course, had not been constructed with this sort of horror in mind at all. So modifications had been made in the dockyard so that we could, in fact, close the ship down and wash it overall to wash any chemicals off or any residue which had stuck, which was perhaps radioactive, on the outside. But to do so effectively meant we had to shut down the fans as well. If you shut down the fans to the boilers won't burn the fuel, and therefore it was impossible to keep anybody in the boiler rooms under those conditions. So we thought in the middle of the tropics it would be a good exercise to shut the ship down and see what happened. And we found that the temperature went up so quickly and so alarmingly that in the engine rooms, where we'd shut the blowers off, because you didn't need that, did you, to make combustion in the engine room, the people were passing out in about 1/4 hour, 20 minutes. And in the mess decks and down below at action stations, they really were not lasting much longer. And so we had to stop this a bit sharpish and duly report it that we didn't think this was practical in the tropics, say the least of it. But it was a marvelous example of the Harry Tate way of, after the event, trying to meet some new threat by saying, well, it'll work in some parts of the world, even if it doesn't work in others. And, of course, the new ships have a rather different way of doing things, different propulsion systems and so on. It was not something I wanted to do again. We were already providing the people working in the boiler rooms and engine rooms with a lot of salt pills every day, which prevented or delayed heat exhaustion setting in. And I had had to make it a punishable offence to get an overdose of sunshine and get sunburn.
Now, do you think that Belfast was a serious warship at the time? Did it have a military stroke naval role in the Far East, or was it a show ship?
She had a military and naval role. The military and naval role was tested, perhaps the hard way, when we went between the island of Formosa and the mainland, when Chiang Kai-shek's people on Formosa and Maoists on the mainland were occasionally shooting at each other. And in order to make a point, we actually went to action stations, although we tried not to look like it. We went in this area between the two of them, where either of them could have opened fire at us. But we were carrying a political clout, and only political clout, in the international field. But Dr. Sukarno in Indonesia was being pretty horrible to British citizens at that time, maybe to all Europeans, I don't know. And in order to put him under pressure, and indeed to meet a very real threat, we had to prepare to evacuate the civilians from Indonesia, the nearest beaches. And I embarked on board a very large number of Royal Marines who were going to occupy the beach long enough for us to get the civilians off. And in order to protect them on that beach, we were quite prepared to fire the guns and all the rest of it. And the guns had a considerable clout, up to about 10, 12 miles range. It was an awful lot of explosive to throw around. But by modern warfare today, its anti-aircraft defense, its missile defense, and so on, would be a non-starter. And you couldn't get it out of harbor quickly if you'd long notice for steam, because you had to slowly warm up the boilers before you put steam on the turbines without risking bending the turbines by giving them too much heat too quickly. And the present ships, you can pretty well start them up like a motor car and get underway. It's entirely different. And their defenses, their electronic defenses and all the rest of it are well, this is like victory going to sea again.
Now, what happened when your commission finished? You'd had this marvellous business where you took her alongside and
The actual process of getting a new ship's company brought out from England new officers and all the rest of it, and handing over to them had to be planned step by step, as you would imagine, and was not an overnight business, because they arrived by the aeroplane, they went to the barracks and so on, and then they had to see round and take over from people, and indeed you had to muster things and sign for them. There was therefore time for a certain amount of farewell business to go on. And my lieutenant commanders, the executive officers, decided they would give me a dinner. And we had an Indonesian dinner with a choice of 104 dishes all on the table that you could help yourself to the day before I flew back home. And it was a very touching gesture of the lieutenant commanders on board, for some of whom I'd done my very best to ensure they got some sort of promotion, but as far as I know, none of them did.
And what about this handover process? Can you describe it?
Well, the formal handover of a captain, for example, to another captain, the new captain arrives on board with formal ceremonies. He's taken down below to sign the certificate that the confidential books are in place. But that's it. The other man then goes over the side, and there's a new captain on board. The other officers, the technical officers, of course, have to see, the supply officer, for example, has to see that there's been an audit of the stores, because no doubt in Napoleonic times there were those who sold the stores for trade. Some of the senior ratings would stay in place in order to pass over the technical niceties of some of the gadgets on board. But broadly speaking, it happens in a matter of days, and can happen very quickly indeed, but we have a matter of days. However, I flew home in a chartered flight, where we stopped two or three times on the way home, and I found we landed at Stansted. And of course, after a long period abroad like that, many of the sailors had presents for their families, and the customs officers at Stansted perhaps had indigestion or had a bad night, and they decided to take it out on these sailors. And really remembering a much earlier event when the home fleet arrived at Portsmouth for Christmas, having been abroad in the Mediterranean for joint exercises, Mediterranean fleet, also with masses of presents for all the families. The customs there were foul too, as though we were smugglers. And the commander-in-chief said all leave is stopped forthwith. He represented to the First Sea Lord and the chief of the customs that this wasn't acceptable, and he was personally prepared to take responsibility for it, and the customs climbed down. Well, with that in my memory, I was perfectly filed for customs at Stansted Airport, then persuaded them that my sailors should not pay duty on all the dolls and games and gewgaws that they'd bought for their families after a year and a half away. It was the last thing I could do for them.
And what happened when you got back? What was your next posting?
Well, my photograph album just says home, January 1961, glorious Devon, because the family was still down at Devon, where the camellias were out already, where the estuary of the Erne was superb, the primroses had just come out, children were tickled pink, and there were sort of welcome home daddy sort of parties, as you can imagine. And I received a commission to Commander J.D.L. Repar, D.S.C.R.N., the Lords Commissioner of the Admiralty, hereby appoint you Commander R.N. of Her Majesty's Ship President Additional on the staff of the Commander-in-Chief Home Fleet Additional. Your appointment to take effect from the 20th of March, 1961. You were also appointed HMS President Additional as Fleet Torpedo and Anti-Submarine Officer on the staff of Commander-in-Chief Home Fleet, and as Staff Torpedo and Anti-Submarine Officer to the Commander-in-Chief Eastern Atlantic, and as the Senior Officer Shipping to Sink Eastland instead of Commander Steady, Peter Steady, who was an old friend of mine anyway. And I duly repaired, I think is the proper word for it, repaired to Northwood, where I was to take up my duties, rather surprisingly, in an underground headquarters, which was rather difficult, different to swanning around the Far East.
Any I should problem? Have asked, when did you leave the Belfast? I didn't...
I left the Belfast, I think, in January 1961.
So this was March you took up this post in...
Yep, I had about 6 weeks, 6 weeks leave. During which time, the first thing we had to do was find somewhere to live, of course.
Where is Northwood? Sorry, is it?
Northwood is near Rickmansworth and was the underground headquarters of the RAF Coastal Command, initially in the country house, and then they burrowed into the ground a bit, and then it was taken over by CNC Home Fleet, who was in the NATO category, the Commander-in-Chief Eastern Atlantic, under the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic, who was an American. And so once more, there started the house hunting business. And we went down to Denham, which was south of there, and we went into all the pubs around Denham. We said, did they know of anybody who was moving out? And eventually we found that somebody in the house in Denham had a cottage there. And we rented the cottage for 6 months. Meanwhile, because Home Fleet had only just moved to Northwood and the Royal Air Force would give up none of their married quarters on the site, they had hundreds of them, they wouldn't give us one. The Commander-in-Chief's secretary, who was a brilliant man, off his own bat saw a housing estate being built just on the outside of the Eastland and RAF place and undertook to buy about half a dozen of the houses. Then he wondered if he was going to be bankrupted for life or whether anybody would back him up, but the CNC backed him up, and so we got a married quarter for the first time in our naval career. And it really was rather fun.
So what was it like? Was it a decent house?
It was a newly built house. It had three-stroke-four bedrooms. It had I think they called it a lounge, which was joined by an archway to a place you would have dinner in. Somebody had sold all the topsoil to somebody else, so it was a place where you couldn't have a garden. And it was being fitted out by Chatham Dockyard, surprisingly, because Chatham was the nearest naval establishment. We happened to be in the Chatham Command for some extraordinary reason. And so Chatham Command solemnly put dockyard mateys into transport every day to bring them up and do a very few hours' work indeed before they had to be got back to Chatham, otherwise they would have been paid overtime. So nothing was done quickly. And we also objected to having all our topsoil taken away, but we found there was topsoil at a naval air station just to the east of Oxford. So we managed to get lorry loads of topsoil brought in there, which we eventually found was taken away from the local sewage plant. But it did grow the most marvellous flowers. And we had a little pathway made straight into the Royal Air Force place. And they were so horrified, the RAF boys and one of their wives, at the idea of naval families living in a place which had been solely RAF up till now. There was distinct standoff between the two for a very long time. Quite extraordinary. Followed not very long afterwards by international NATO trouble. General de Gaulle was running the show in France, and he didn't like being in NATO where he had to do what he was told or have agreement from the North Atlantic Council as to what he was doing. So he removed his staff officers. We had a Frenchman there. He removed his staff officers from the fleet. It was one of my other jobs was press liaison for this lot. I had to arrange people from all nationalities to come and watch our exercises at sea, because I did go to sea in the fleet, because I was responsible for the anti-submarine bit of it, torpedo and anti-submarine bit. And the major threat in the Atlantic at that time came from the Russian submarines. And I was therefore at sea quite often helping to run these exercises, which I also planned.
And you were responsible for getting the press there as well.
Yes, I took them to see. And one had to accept anybody who had a proper press pass.